Michael Rupert was interviewed by Abe Proctor on the Joe Urys Show, which was broadcast between 7:30 and 9 a.m. Tuesday, August 30th. I'm Glenn Owen, and we'll join them shortly into the interview.
In order to offset known decline right now, we would have to find three more Saudi Arabias just to offset known decline, and this at a time when demand is still increasing. We aren't going to. It's not going to happen.
Now, I've been reading an article you posted on your website March 10th of this year called I Am Not a Politician.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that, you describe a conversation you had with a 17-year-old CIA veteran in which you say every country in the world is betting everything it has on this one hand, knowing that after 2007 or 2008, the game ends.
Right.
The map of the future after that is unknowable and, to a large extent, irrelevant.
Right.
So I'm wondering, you know, it sounds as if everybody in the petroleum industry and in government, for that matter, has known about this for a long time then. So why this colossal short-sightedness? Why this disconnect between what we all know we need to do and what has actually been done?
Well, first of all, I really don't think we do know what we need to do. I think we have been medicating ourselves with psychological constructs about things that might help, very few of which are going to make a damn bit of difference in any of this. Hybrids are a joke. It's too late for hybrids. It takes 2,500 gallons of gasoline to make a hybrid. There are 7 gallons of oil in every new tire. Switching the world's fleet of 700 million internally combustion-powered vehicles to hybrids would use up all the remaining oil and collapse the world economy as it is. People have not learned how to think about peak oil. Clearly, though, the government did know. And in my book, Crossing the Rubicon, which is the best-selling book about 9/11 after the Cain Commission report, I document clearly that Dick Cheney was aware of peak oil back in 1999. The National Energy Policy Development Group, his secret task force, which went to the Supreme Court to keep its records secret, clearly knew about peak oil. And yet their response was to go around the world and engage in wars to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. And as we've seen, that hasn't done any good because Iraq is an absolute mess.
Yeah.
But as I make clear in everything I have written for about the last 3 years, we are all a victim or criminal co-conspirators in the way money works. It is not profitable to slow decline. And the way peak oil has been addressed has been governed by economic, monetary, and financial forces, and we have all been criminally complicit because we have accepted that paradigm.
So by our collective failure to make different choices, we are accessories to this global crime.
Absolutely.
Now, getting back to a statement you made earlier, why do you believe that the United States, and by extension the global industrialized economy, will be unable to recover at this point?
Well, first of all, nothing exists in a vacuum anymore. The global market is not an American market, the global oil market. It's a global market for oil. You take 1 million barrels of production out of any place in the world, and the whole world pays the price. There is no elasticity anywhere to make anything up.
Are we running that close to capacity?
We are exceeding capacity. Demand has been exceeding capacity for the last 3 months. So where we are right now is that we are already going to see monstrous impacts, just projecting even a short bit from what we know now about the damage caused by Katrina. Huge ripples. The airlines are already teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. Now they've lost not only all their business, but they've lost much of their aviation fuel. And we have seen just in the last month that airlines had suspended service because they couldn't get aviation gas. Now the price of that gasoline is going to go up. So the airlines go. That's an economic fallout. All the retail, commercial, industrial banking business, the mortgage business, is going to collapse because that's a huge chunk of the U.S. economy. It's cash flow down there. Alan Greenspan just last weekend, great timing, Mr. Greenspan, finally announced, oh, yeah, the housing bubble is going to pop any minute, and it should. It should. Yes, of course it should. We've been saying that from the wilderness for 2.5 years. But see, all of these things now are interrelated because you cannot have economic growth, which is what the world's economic paradigm requires, without hydrocarbon energy. If you don't have growth, it collapses.
So we've all been collectively fiddling while Rome burns.
Well, we have. Some of us have not.
Right. But enough of us have.
I think for the most part, people who have been unafraid to face the true implications of peak oil have been tossing out some really stupid and unproductive solutions, like hydrogen cars and all kinds of stuff that won't amount to a hill of beans and make a difference for a crisis that's upon us now. And as we've said it from the wilderness, again, for more than 3.5 years, until you address the energy infrastructure, you don't solve anything either. So this is now a time more than ever. And one of the reasons why I love Portland so much is that y'all have gotten this whole concept of relocalization clearly. I just had several major speaking engagements in Oregon back earlier in June. And I love Oregon. I'm going to move there one of these days. And but you all are aware that the only solution to peak oil is to relocalize. Globalization is dead. Food production must convert to local food production. And people have got to start building their own lifeboats with the person standing right next to them. That's the only way to survive.
And I imagine we're all going to have to accept some basic concessions, that we may not be able to have everything we want exactly when we want it.
To say the least.
We may not be able to have exotic out-of-season produce whenever we want it, and any number of other things. Let me ask you something else about that article I mentioned earlier. You say, as the evidence grows stronger that we are at peak now, or very close to it, there is a distinct correlation between oil price hikes and military budget increases, weapons deployment, warfare, and covert operations around the world. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, all you got to do is watch the daily news to
yeah.
see what's going on around the world. And you know, certainly Iraq is an absolute disaster. We're going to soon publish a story by the great Stan Goff describing what has evolved in Iraq, which is really now that the neocons have lost control. It's not even about them trying to partition Iraq to protect the oil. Iraq is out of control, and there's not going to be any help. That's about 100 billion barrels of oil. Of course, you can't turn that on like a faucet. The infrastructure is totally damaged. It takes $15, $20 billion to rebuild it just to get that oil, and you will never have peace or stability there. So everything we're doing is counterproductive. We see a lot of rumor and talk about an invasion of Iran. I am absolutely convinced that the U.S. will never invade Iran. The rest of the world will nuke us immediately because they cannot live without Iranian oil. Of course, there's Hugo Chavez has been in the news in Venezuela enormously lately. We see an explosion, if you will, that's a pun, I guess, of so-called guerrilla activity in the Philippines. Anywhere there's oil or oil transit routes since 9/11, we have seen this explosion of covert operations and military activity, which is proving to be totally counterproductive.
So what do we do then? Or is there the time left or the resources left to do anything?
In my opinion, with the arrival of Katrina, it depends solely upon how you define do. And, you know, what you define as doing something. If you're talking about going to the U.S. government to try to make it change any of its policies, I believe that that is about as dumb as going to the captain of the Titanic while it is sinking after it has been struck and demanding that the captain rebuild the ship. It's not going to happen.
So, well, how do you define do then?
Well, survival, as I have said now for almost 2 years consistently, will be place-based and local. It will be neither individual, nor will it be societal, governmental, or national. It will be based upon community. It will be based upon small groups of people, tribes, if you will, neighborhoods, forming collective, mutually supportive living arrangements, attempting to be self-sustaining, place-based, and locally. That's it.
Now, I can see all sorts of, I think the term collateral damage is overused and misused a lot of the time. But in this case, I mean, I wonder about communities, for example, like, say, Phoenix, Arizona, where there's far too many people living there, you know, than is practically possible. And they've only been sustained, for example, by essentially drinking the Colorado River dry before it reaches the Gulf of California. And I imagine that communities in these sorts of places that have been allowed to prosper only because they've been dependent to a large degree on hydrocarbon energy, I mean, there's going to be a lot of, I mean, what are we looking at here? Widespread death and disease and famine?
And massive population dislocation, yes.
Wow.
Look, before the age of petroleum, And this is I've lectured more than probably 40 times in 9 or 10 countries since 9/11. And there's only one slide in all of my lectures that has remained for every one of those lectures, and it's a population graph. The population graph shows that the population of the Earth at the time of Christ was stable at 2 billion people, and there it remained, with an exception for a dip for the bubonic plague, until the advent of wood-fired steam and then coal-fired steam, when it started gradual increases. But when oil began to be used as an industrial power, population was about 2.2 billion people, and since that curve rockets, it takes off straight up to 6.5 billion people. Reading that chart, the science is very good that 4.5 billion people are only here because of oil. There are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food consumed on the planet. When you take into account the internal combustion-powered vehicles that plant, harvest the hydrocarbon energy used to generate electricity, to irrigate, the fertilizers, the pesticides, the driving the food to production facilities, then to your store, etc. You take away the oil, you take away the food. The current population level, given the crisis that is on us now, I'm not talking about the theories about how perhaps permaculture might support 9 billion people. We don't have that time anymore. I'm a strong fan of permaculture and organic agriculture that does not rely on hydrocarbon energy. It is a good stuff, but we have a lot of soil restoration to do. Much of our soil has been paved over with pavement. Monsanto is now controlling much of the seed supply. They've just patented a pig, for God's sake. So, yes, this dislocation is inevitable, and the have-nots will be looking strongly to the haves, and you can bet that there's going to be conflict.
And I imagine that in the complexity that has arisen, the economic and social complexity in a modern industrialized economy, we're going to have all sorts of people whose specialized training simply won't apply in the post-peak world. And I imagine we're going to have a lot of very quickly re-educated farmers and occupations like that.
I mean, unfortunately, most of our wonderful knowledge of farming in this country has been destroyed by agribiz.
Right.
One book I would like to see written on a very short-term basis is Emergency Farming in Urban Areas. A lot of work needs to be done in that area. But fortunately, throughout the Pacific Northwest, let's say from roughly Marin County in California north all the way through Seattle, this awakening is already taking place. That's why I'm so enamored and so in love with the Pacific Northwest, especially Oregon. This awakening is taking place there rapidly.
But I'm forced to wonder if it's, if we're wide enough awake at this point. I mean, we essentially face here, despite, the advances that you're citing, the same problems that communities everywhere face.
Well, you have a head start. That's the point. This is, is the glass half full or half empty? Do
right.
you want to be grateful
right.
for what you got, or do you want to lament what you don't have?
That's a good point.
What is extant in the Pacific Northwest is probably 5 years ahead of the thinking of the rest of the country. Now, there are certain exceptions, of course, like, in some of the Appalachian region, some of the upper Midwest, some of the rural areas with good consciousness throughout the country. But the major metropolitan areas don't have a clue, and the ones like Phoenix or Las Vegas, they are, in effect, teetering on the edge of the cliff.
So are we looking at a second Dark Ages?
Well, I don't even think that far ahead. With global warming now so clearly upon us, a great poll on CNN, 85% of the respondents believed that Katrina was worsened by global warming. Well, it's maybe better late than never to wake up. I think it's abundantly clear that climate collapse is on us all over the globe. I mean, it's not just happening here in the U.S. Look, all of human civilization may be at stake here.
The president says there's no evidence of global warming is actually happening.
Well, the president lies about every second time he opens his mouth out of three times.
That's very true. Hey, listen, do you have some time to take some questions from callers this morning?
Sure.
All right. Who do we have first, Eduardo? Greg, you're up first.
Hello?
Can you turn your radio down for us?
Certainly.
Okay, you're on. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I've been citizen advocate on peak oil for a long time, and now it appears as if climate change and a bunch of other things are just pigpiling our civilization at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You look at this, nobody's talking about the petroleum futures market people, the people that, if you Google downstream ventures, there's a petroleum market board there that has a lot of information on what's going on with this, with down in Katrina, with what's happened. Something on the order of 30% of the refining capacity of the United States was directly in that path.
Right.
There were 600 offshore rigs that were in that path. The only supertanker port in the United States that can handle supertankers was in Louisiana.
Right.
And so we may be seeing $3 a gallon gas by the end of the week, $5 by the end of the month, and nobody knows where it can go because they have no idea how much of the capacity of the United States has just been knocked out.
And that's the last thing, of course, that the oil industry will want to tell the financial markets, but it's going to be very hard to keep that a secret. Now we have.
Oh, no. Well, you see, like George runs a one site, Urban, oh boy, it's Urban Survival, and he has somebody that's on the inside of one of the oil companies there that's been broadcasting just how badly the damage is. But like I said, check Petroleum Traders Boards because they've been tracking just how much of the system is damaged. They're talking about the kind of things that happen are like ships pull their anchors up, and then when the anchor drags along the bottom, it hits a natural gas line, and so much for the natural gas line. But with the idea of there being 600 rigs that were in the path of this hurricane, I'm starting to think that we may be facing here the kind of a triggering event that can make a whole bunch of other things.
That's exactly right. I mean, you have to take into account how much hydrocarbon energy would be used to rebuild all this stuff. That's the one thing that most people don't even think about. They don't even ask questions.
It pulls out from the site, but okay, now if we're at peak now, we've still got a cushion of probably months or years before you end up in a situation where you get into that 3 to 5% the 3 to 5% reduction in available stocks.
I disagree.
That's supposed to happen on the far side.
You disagree, Michael?
I disagree.
Once you're at
peak, you start into irreversible decline. And what we don't know, because everybody has lied about their reserves. The Saudis have lied. OPEC has lied. Remember, Shell had to downgrade their reserve estimates four times over the course of the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And
the
infrastructure doesn't exist
right now
to produce that cushion. Oil in the ground does not translate to oil in your tank.
I understand that. What I'm concerned about is that you believe that we are at peak now and that we are in terminal decline now?
Well, I believe that what Katrina has done by taking so much offline is to force a peak. In other words, the ability to recover from this is also going to depend upon having not only the energy that you lost as a result of Katrina, but the excess energy above that needed to rebuild the infrastructure. And if we're already in decline, the rubber band breaks.
Correct. I understand this, but I'm kind of at what I'm more concerned about than the actual energy and rebuilding is the effects on the financial markets. Because
absolutely true.
You're looking at financial collapse probably preceding any actual major decline in the availability of the stocks.
And one other way of saying that is that if there is a financial collapse, and of course my regular readers at FromTheWilderness.com and those who've read my book, Crossing the Rubicon, but especially my newsletter readers, have been aware that I've been saying the economic crash comes the end of 2005. That's even before Katrina. So if there isn't an economic collapse, what you lose is the capital necessary to pay for the rebuilding of the infrastructure.
Exactly. I'm understanding it. Mike, you're still my hero, and I still chatted with you four or five times. But
God bless.
At this stage of the game, I've gone into production of a seed bank, and I'm battening down the hatches.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody should start growing, learn how to grow anything they possibly can in your backyard, restoring your soil, and getting out of debt.
Well, I got a mortgage, but I got 150 fruit trees. So at this stage of the game, I got the mortgage paid down long enough to where I'm. If there's any kind of a system going, well, I can chug along through it. But
just don't tell the people in Phoenix where you live.
Oh, yeah, well, Eagle Creek will be good.
Hey, thanks for the call, Greg. Appreciate your comments.
Bye.
Michael, I have a question that kind of ties into something Greg asked. Now, we're seeing prices at the pump that are a shock to most motorists, but at the same time, I'm hearing that petroleum companies are posting record profits.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that ExxonMobil, I think in the first quarter of this year, posted the largest profits ever recorded by an American
mm-hmm.
corporation. So if the costs of extraction are going up, and if allegedly those costs are being passed on to consumers, and that's why we're seeing higher prices at the pump, why then the record profits?
It's very simple. The oil companies are investing next to nothing in exploration. Why?
So,
because they know there's nothing left to find.
So we're simply being bled dry, even as everything collapses?
Yes.
Oh, well,
now,
that's
one of the things that I said very recently, twice. I said it in a meeting with Congressman Roscoe Bartlett. I said it in a speech I recently gave in Soulfest, and I wrote this on the website, is that a rational society now would be taking the oil company's money and rebuilding America's railroad infrastructure, which would probably save more lives in this country than anything else. But that's not going to happen. We're not going to have a revolution. We aren't going to have somebody elected or some congressional. That takes years.
Yeah.
And people who delude themselves that government is still working, in my opinion, and this is going to sound very crass, are candidates for Darwinian deselection.
And given that the government has already demonstrated that they're willing to project military force halfway around the globe to secure what supplies remain,
right,
can we expect them then to hold out to the very bitter end?
Well, that all depends. I mean, there are many weak planks in this structure of civilization. I forget the name of the game where everybody pulls out one piece until the whole thing collapses.
Jenga.
Yeah, well, thank you, but... You know, stop looking for one piece. I mean, we're seeing the beginnings, I think belated, of a popular revolt against the war in Iraq, like we saw in Vietnam. But look, that's not going to have any effect for a long time. The whole world is in many ways rising up against the U.S. empire, which is now thoroughly and obviously in decline.
Yeah,
I mean, all around the world. Hugo Chavez regularly thumbs his nose at us, but so do Russia and China. They just held their first ever war games in the Central Asian republics, and Russia and China demanded that the U.S. leave its military bases in Central Asia. The world is standing up to this empire with impunity, and that is not going to make the outcome of Katrina any better either. Don't look for any help from the rest of the world.
No, and I find that decline more irritating than anything. Talk about the greatest waste of potential in all of human history.
Well, yeah, but it's also utterly consistent with every other empire in human
history. Yeah, it is. It is.
So, you know, why are we expecting this case will be different? That's another definition of insanity, you know?
Well, you know, I had hoped, and maybe I guess I have to assume that I am naive to believe this, that, you know, 500 years after the beginning of the Age of Reason, that maybe we had arrived at a point in history where we could decide to sidestep that historical trap and not be the empire that collapsed, but rather, the civilization that led humanity to some sort of sustainable future.
Well, I think our biggest mistake is that we have assumed that human intelligence was the be-all and end-all, the sine qua non without equal of the universe, and we have arrogantly worshipped our own intelligence while forgetting that we have to be reconciled with nature and every living thing on this planet. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that Mother Earth is declaring war on us like an infection.
I'd have to agree. Well, let's go back to the phones. How long do you have with us this morning, Michael?
At least another hour, if you want that.
Well, I'm on for another half hour. We'll take you as long as you can stay.
Well, I'm here.
All right, that's wonderful. Jim, you're up next. Good morning.
Good morning, Abe. Thank you for being on the earth, Mike. Question for you, Abe, and that question for you, Mike. Abe, as I listen in this interview, you sound... like reluctant to believe what Mike is saying, looking for the peace, as he says, that gives us an out. And there is no escape. We've got to quit our jobs and take to the earth, and a world without, take to farming, and a world without oil is just about going back to the 1880s. That's all that it means. It isn't the end of the world. It's just back to the farm.
Well, there's a big problem there.
There is a big problem there.
In the 1880s, there was only like 2.5 billion people on the planet. Today, we've got $4 billion above that.
Yeah, and we've got telephones, and we've got electricity that they didn't have in 1880. And maybe that will help, and maybe it won't. I don't know. But the question to you, Abe, was what does it take in the progression of information that reaches your tipping point where you basically quit your job and go to the farm? And to keep track of the evidence that leads you to the your ruling and your own personal behavior, and then try to recreate that sequence for others. It's not a question that you can answer right off, but if you would just watch your own thought processes, Abe, it would be an important sequence to capture. Mike, for you, what do you think of the possibility of electing a whole slate of 435 replacements in the U.S. House next year? I'll just leave it at that. No party, just a slate of 435, like Newt, nationalize the House elections so that we vote for this national interest over our local district interest.
Have you missed the fact that Diebold and Choice Point control the election software?
Well, it would have to include going back to paper ballots between now and then. I understand there's a lot of...
You want to implement all that in the next year? I would sooner bet on me flying to the moon unassisted.
Mike is not a very optimistic guy when he's faced with all of the things. But that was just the idea.
I've been walking around Capitol Hill since 1979.
Would be a clean house.
I've been walking around Capitol Hill since 1979. Government is broken. You ought to read my last two stories on Cynthia McKinney's
I have.
Brilliant last-ditch effort. Government's broken.
I understand.
You're not
going to
take it back. The electoral process is hijacked. It's not even in our control anymore. You would have to start a 10-year process to make a change in 1 year for a crisis that's on us today.
Or the realization of the people, if they could all snap out somehow quick. I don't know what it is either, but that's the only possibility that I see, and it's a fairly vague possibility. One last question I'll leave you. I just wanted to leave it with this opening in case you wanted to pursue it. Otherwise, leave it dead. Mike, if you wanted to say something about Wayne Madsen, then I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, I've been in contact with Wayne. He's fine. It's under control. We all have to expect stuff like this. There were strong, incredible rumors that a hit had been ordered against Wayne. He's taken the right moves. He is not alone. And there's a lot of people watching his back. That's all I'm really at liberty to say.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about Wayne?
Wayne's a former officer, I believe, lieutenant with the Office of Naval Intelligence and National Security Agency. He was a freelance journalist in Washington, very good friend of Cynthia McKinney's. He and I acted as questioners at her July 22nd briefing on June 22nd briefing on 9/11 on Capitol Hill. He's been a friend for some time. Very outspoken critic of the neocons who just enjoy sticking it to him.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Chad, you're up next.
Hi. I've got a question about the Phoenix and the Las Vegas situation. I mean, isn't that essentially dependent on the hydrological cycle? I mean, they get they tap the Colorado and they get electrical power and water. So how is that dependent on petroleum?
Well, what you've missed is the fact that the water tables all over the country are in massive decline. The Colorado River is almost dry. And no, they do not get all their electrical power from the Colorado River. Much of that is sent to Los Angeles. They get their electrical power by burning natural gas.
Yeah, and
coal.
But
and there's also the fact that Phoenix and Las Vegas are built after that almost archetypal Western model of built around automobiles as the primary mode of transport. They're sprawling, they're not dense, and they're the sorts of places that would be hit harder by an energy crunch than any place.
That's how they get their food, is by gasoline.
Okay.
And as gasoline prices go up, I've just started research. Now, we are beginning to see some signs of societal collapse. First of all, mass transport ridership has soared, while mass transportation budgets are being broken by oil prices even today. School buses are a classic example. All around the country in rural states, school bus operations are getting ready to shut down because they can't buy fuel to take children to school. That's just the beginning. So places like Phoenix, Las Vegas, all of those hot desert places on non-arable land are doomed. I'm sorry, they're doomed.
And maybe the air conditioning is a problem unless they can go to a...
You better believe it. I mean, I live in Los Angeles, and we've had like 10 straight days over 100 here in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah. Well, Chad, you there?
Yeah, I guess, okay. I guess there'd be more involved than just the water, though. I mean...
Much more involved, but the water is almost as critical a crisis as oil is now.
Uh-huh.
Water tables are down all over the world. Private corporations are trying to privatize water.
Uh-huh.
And that was tried with ruinous results in Argentina, as I recall.
Bolivia,
excuse me. Hey, Chad, appreciate your call. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Bye.
Okay, Mike, essentially you're painting a picture that's pretty bleak. And Jim is right. I am reluctant to accept that because I would like to believe that there's some way that we can both cure ourselves of our worst habits and yet preserve that which is best about our civilization.
Well, you know, I love the people who think that by going out and buying a hybrid, they're saving the world. They're accelerating its demise. Why? Because it took 2,500 gallons of oil to make that hybrid. And secondly, their used car became another car on the road that somebody else is now driving, demanding as much oil or more.
So if we're going to preserve industrialized society...
We are not going to preserve industrialized society. It's impossible.
Oh, okay. Well, there it is. When I asked you before if we're looking at a new dark ages, I guess in many ways we are, because without industrialized society, we're going to essentially lose the advances we've made in medical science, for example, in high technology, in communications, in any number of things are simply not going to be feasible anymore in terms of the energy required to produce them.
Well, or maintain them.
Now, or maintain them.
This is where I'm in complete accord with the great and wonderful Richard Heinberg, author of The Parties Over and Power Down. We both see the world devolving, much like the world did after the fall of the Roman Empire, into monastic or feudal enclaves where some knowledge will be protected, preserved, and used for a while.
But that's what I'm talking about, the dark ages.
The whole civilization.
Yeah.
But the mistake that I see everybody making is they say, okay, we're in the industrial age now, peak oil hits, and then we'll have the post-industrial age. What they do not even stop to think about is the transition period between the two. The foremost challenge is not preparing for a post-petroleum lifestyle. The foremost challenge is to survive the transition.
I see. But you're also postulating that we lack the energy resources to convert our economy to something that's driven by a fuel other than petroleum.
There are no alternatives to hydrocarbon energy. None.
What about a Manhattan Project into an alternate form of energy?
Peak oil is here today. How long did the Manhattan Project take? I believe it was started in 1941. 39 or 40 or 41 at the University of Chicago. That took 4 or 5 years. But then you would have to replace the energy infrastructure. According to Professor David Goodstein, the vice chancellor of Caltech here in California, wrote a great book about the end of the age of oil. It takes 30 years to change an energy infrastructure. We don't have that time.
So the immediate focus has to be on surviving the transition.
Exactly.
And that at some point, the pieces will have to be picked up.
No. Most of the pieces will never be picked up.
What I'm talking about is a return to scientific progress, to beneficial scientific progress, a lot of which depends upon technology.
The question now is about survival. It's not about progress.
Well, I understand that. I'm looking way down the road here. Will there ever be a return?
That's 150 years down
right.
the road.
Right.
I don't know.
That's what I'm talking about. At some point, if we want to...
If we have a global climate collapse, the human beings could die as rapidly as the dinosaurs and the woolly mammoths did.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Mike, you're next up on the phones. How are you doing this morning?
All right, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
You know, I sit back and I listen to a lot of what you guys discuss. You guys are aware of the situation with D-Bolt. You know that popular vote will never, ever in America... decided an election. You already know that, and you guys have conceded that point, and so nobody's going to do anything about it. And as I sit back and listen to white people talk about the problems that goes on, I come to the conclusion that white people have forgot how to revolt. The forms of protest that most white people take nowadays is to intellectualize something, to write books, and to give seminars. And that's the extent of their revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's why things are not changing. And I think that what needs to happen is I think that the people on the bottom that has been the most oppressed in your society is the one that can show you how to change things, because the Constitution is clear. It says that when a government no longer serves the need of the people, it is your duty, your obligation to overthrow it.
Yeah.
But you guys sit back and you already know that the government is definitely not for you anymore, but yet you don't talk about overthrowing it. All you talk about is how to survive it, and I think that's where you're wrong.
Well, okay, that goes to whether a successful revolution is possible. Let me just say that the single greatest compliment I have ever been paid in my entire life was given to me by the Honorable Cynthia McKinney, my dear friend of Georgia, who is an African-American. We were a couple of years ago in South Central Los Angeles at a museum about the Watts riots, and we were looking at pictures of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, the Black Panthers, and there was a picture of an LAPD black and white circa 1966 or something, you know, making some arrests of black people. And Cynthia looked at me and she said, "Mike, that's what you did when you used to be white. That's the best compliment I've ever been paid. I, for one, would sign on to a revolution tomorrow. The problem is that I don't think that a critical mass of the American people would join it. Now, it's very clear to me that the first people to die and to suffer as a result of peak oil will be the working class, will be the poor, will be minorities, just like they were in New Orleans, the ones that couldn't get out. And if there is an awakening there and some kind of a coalescence across the country, that is something that might make a difference. I'm not holding my breath, but if you read my writings closely over the last several years, you'll see that I agree with what you say, that nothing short of a revolution is going to change anything. I just don't think the American people, even many blacks, because I see a lot of black leadership being totally co-opted in this country, probably wouldn't sign on to it.
I agree with you. I'm not going to take much more of your time. I agree with you. I just think that as I've studied American history, I see that the farther away from the revolution that the white Americans was involved in when they was getting their freedom from Europe, the further they got away from that period of time, the less effective they have been to change the course of what's going on in America. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay.
I'd have to agree with that. What also comes to my mind when contemplating revolution is that I doubt it would be successful in strictly military terms. We're so far outgunned by the other side.
Actually, no, we're not.
No?
Absolutely not, and that is one of the worst myths. And actually, the right-wing, so-called anti-government people, have done more to perpetrate that myth than anybody else by telling us all there's concentration camps everywhere and blah, blah, blah. Stan Goff and I have looked at the numbers. There's barely more than a regiment, which is about 1,200 men of military troops available to control the entire country.
Well, I'm talking about toys. We don't have F-15s or tanks or guided missiles or anything like that.
They won't use F-15s or tanks against cities. That destroys the value of their own real estate.
That's true. So
we could do it if we wanted to. There's 170 million firearms in this country.
So in your mind, it's more a question of public will than of public equipment.
Absolutely.
We're in the gray zone here talking about our revolution on the radio.
I'll probably be arrested before the day's over for having said that on your radio station, but so what?
So surviving a transition, in your mind, comes down to localizing and building communities that are as self-sustainable as possible. And and to the extent that these communities are interdependent, it's going to be have to be on a local or regional scale.
Yes.
So then when I leave this radio station today and then I go to my job later and I come home, what do I need to do? What does the average person need to do? Do they need to invest in seeds? What needs to be done?
Well, no one size fits all. Everybody needs a personal inventory of their own life. I mean, one of the things that I love, I just clipped this story about how all the many restaurants in Oregon are not going organic, they're going local. I mean, they're advertising that the food is grown locally, right? And especially around Portland and, you know, Eugene, all up and down the state.
That's true.
Well, that's what needs to happen. You need to talk to your neighbors. That's what the first thing you need to do, and that's what we've forgotten how to do. You know, if you have some soil in the backyard, I go out and, you know, start to get some books right now, and we're starting to offer products on our site that are going to help this, and we're going to get there, to look and evaluate the quality of the soil in your own backyard for what you can grow there or what your neighbors can grow, how you can, you know, how many different parts in a local neighborhood can perform multitasking to support the neighborhood. A few years back, we wrote some incredible stories by Dale Allen Pfeiffer, our energy editor, where we contrasted what North Korea did when it lost oil versus what Cuba did. And Cuba did exactly what has to be done. And these sites, you just go to the From the Wilderness website and search for Cuba and North Korea. It'll take you to those stories. And you look at what Cuba's done, and even having lost oil, which is essential for fertilizers, for pesticides, and having lost the natural gas, too, their food production is slowly increasing. But that's a twofold thing. One, it's organic, permaculture, and second, it's relocalization at the local level to create local place-based economies.
And Cuba's even managed to export healthcare professionals throughout the Caribbean and South American region.
Yeah.
Roger, you're next on the phone. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing okay. I wanted to thank Mike for calling in. I think that was really stellar. But I had a question. I wanted to make a comment that years ago, when I still had eyesight, on a PBS program, I can't think of the name of it, but the Defense Journal. They did a high level camera shot in the desert, and you could see all the way to the horizon, brand new tanks, mothballed, millions. Can we win a revolution against that?
Again, they don't have the troops to drive them. You got to have human beings to drive the troops. Has anybody noticed there's a huge manpower shortage in the military? The draft is right around the corner. Cindy Crawford's not doing anything for recruitment, and the military doesn't have why are people talking about us invading Iran? It's patently absurd.
Well, no, I'm not thinking about that. What I'm thinking is that in a serious decline, there won't be anything for people to do except hunker down or join the military.
No, there will be other things for people to do. Die, starve.
If you don't know how to do anything else but join the military, that's...
Become a migrant labor force that will serve the mega corporations and just exactly like the 1930s. Go look at the Grapes of Wrath again. They don't need concentration camps. They'll just let tens of millions of unemployed homeless move to fight over jobs.
Yeah. It doesn't look very good, but I graduated from high school in 1964. And when I adjust the price of gasoline for inflation, I find out that I should be paying $6 a gallon today. Why did...
No.
Why on earth did the price, the retail price, lose 70% up until a couple of years ago, just exactly the way the minimum wage lost 70%?
Well, you've got a couple of things that need tweaking there. First of all, adjusted for 1968 prices, we are way past that, and no, we shouldn't be paying $6 a gallon, we've been tracking here what the so-called economists put out about adjusting for inflation, and they keep changing the baseline for what they calculated.
Yeah, I understand that, but
secondly,
I mean, I look at prices. I go to the grocery store, and I see what I used to buy in 1964, and then I use that to decide.
Well,
you
but secondly,
contact
the whole world has subsidized cheap oil for the United States through dollar hegemony around the world, because we've made the rest of the world buy T-bills and buy American bonds so that they can turn around and buy oil, which is priced in dollars. That's been an artificial subsidy for the United States, and believe me, that's going away very quickly.
So it was a subsidy that kept the price slightly lower, or a lot lower.
A subsidy which has penalized the rest of the world, which is now slightly pissed off at us.
Oh, they're way ticked off.
Yeah, thank you.
We saw that on 9/11, didn't we?
No, they hate us for our freedom.
9/11 was orchestrated by Richard Cheney. I'm sorry. My book establishes that definitively. That wasn't perpetrated by 19 guys working out of a cave in Afghanistan.
Well, they had to be allowed to do what they did.
They were facilitated and orchestrated, and I have proved it in my book.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't just turn our back and let it happen. Dick Cheney scheduled 6 overlapping war games on the same day to paralyze U.S. fighter response, moving a significant portion out of the country and inserting 22 false radar blips on radar screens, while also conducting a live fly exercise so that the Air Force wouldn't know where to go to stop the planes.
Wow.
In my book, Crossing the Rubicon, you might want to take a look because it really tells us what we're all up against.
Hey, listen, Roger, thank you.
I will take a look at that.
Thanks for the call. I've got to squeeze a couple more in before the end here. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Brian, you're up next. Good morning.
Oh, already? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I've got a question and just a quick statement, and then I'll... I'm designing a 60-unit condominium development down by the coast, and we are putting it in, hopefully, affordable. And we're putting a community garden in as part of it, and greenhouses and stuff.
Good,
and,
good.
I'm about
good.
Halfway through Mr. Rupert's book, and, you know, I'm still absorbing some of it. there are some of us thinking about that reasonably futuristically, and, I'm trying
to... Solar up and also start some biodiesel.
Yeah, okay, great. And one other question, though, and I asked Helen Caldicott this once directly when she came over here, and she answered a few things she never had an answer for. If there was a critical mass revolution... and if we could change things, do you think the military-industrial people would just press the button rather than accept our dominance? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
That's a good question.
Pressing the button kind of implied nuclear. I think we would see a lot of other things done.
I think he's asking, would the power structure crack down on us decisively rather than accept critical mass of people demanding a change?
Yes, but I ultimately think that if that critical mass were reached, the power structure would prove to be the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz.
There's no there.
Exactly.
Okay. Andrew, you're up next. Good morning.
Good morning. Mike, I heard you say a few minutes ago that you think invading Iran is a crazy idea. There's no manpower for the U.S. to do it.
It's not going to happen.
But it seems of primary importance to the U.S. government to stop Tehran from opening its oil market next March. And I'm curious if you believe that's the case, and if you do, how do you think the U.S. will try and stop the opening of the Iranian oil bourse?
Okay, well, first of all, I think, yes, we are going to try it, but I think it's being made very clear to the neocons. And bear in mind, the neocons are not the top tier. That's the big mistake everybody makes.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the world is making it abundantly clear that anything which jeopardizes Iranian oil production will not be tolerated. Japan, China, India, Malaysia, Brazil, Indonesia, much of Western Europe cannot survive with a loss of Iranian oil, especially now in the wake of Katrina, because we're going to be sucking up more oil than anybody else just trying to catch up. The world will, it'll be a global nuclear holocaust the moment the United States decides to attack or invade Iran. All you have to do is ask yourself one simple question. After the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq in March of 2003, did Iraqi oil production go up or did it go down?
Oh, it plummeted.
Of course. And Iraqi infrastructure is toast. It was already toast. Now it's, I don't know what you'd call it, salvage. Okay? But the world cannot do without Iranian oil, and it will not permit a U.S. attack or invasion, period.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew, for the call. We're going to have to start winding it down here, Michael. I feel like we're just getting rolling here. This is kind of frustrating. Let me ask you a couple questions about some things you just said. You said the neocons are not the top tier. Then who is the top tier? Are we talking people like the transnational executive class that makes up the Carlyle Group, for example?
This is something else that people don't get. It's not who is the top tier. It's what is the top tier.
Okay, what is the top
tier? It's the way money works. We live in a world that's based on fractional reserve banking, fiat currency, and debt-based growth. One of the most ominous quotes I heard in Paris in 2003 was a Dutch economist saying it very clearly. It may not be profitable to slow decline. It's the profit motive operating on behalf of corporations and major banks that is removing every solution from the table. And any human being you put up and plug into that ecosystem is going to behave exactly the same way as the human being you just removed.
A self-defeating system.
Yes.
And one more question, and I'll let you go. What do you think the possibility is of conscription in the near future in the United States?
It is inevitable. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet. But, again, we also do acknowledge, and I thoroughly acknowledge the possibility that with economic collapse, as one of your callers said, they may forestall a draft just because people will enlist just for three hots and a cot.
Jeez. Well, Mr. Rupert, I really appreciate you spending time with us this morning. It was a deeply provocative discussion, and I hope we can have you back sometime.
I'd love to. I love Portland. I love Oregon. You guys just keep doing what you're doing. You're ahead of everybody. Just
and,
keep it up.
Look us up when you move to town.
Don't worry, I will.
Thank you very much. It was Michael Rupert, author of Crossing the Rubicon, also the author of FromTheWilderness.com, a very informative new website on a range of issues. We were just talking about the problem of peak oil and all the problems that descend from it today. Wonderful discussion. Thank you all for listening. There is a group, Portland Peak Oil, that meets weekly at St. Francis Church at the corner of 12th and Southeast Pine. You can find out about when their meetings happen at portlandpeakoil.org. My name is Abe Proctor. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. I'll see you next week, and thank you for tuning in. Bye-bye. Para que puedas recordarme siempre acá. Dame en tu verso una razón. The following are short statements made by one or two of the 19 candidates running for the KBOO Board of Directors. Cable members will be getting a ballot mailed to them in September, and listeners can also tune in to the candidates' forums on September 6th, 7th, and 8th to hear more from all of our candidates. So here comes some candidate statements.
For the KBOO Board of Directors to further my contribution to the station. KBOO is an essential community resource, and I feel I must do as much as I can to support it. It would be an honor to help direct the station. My contribution would be as a cohesive element. I work and play well with others and have experience working with a broad range of people. I am capable of seeing most issues from a variety of sides. I can help others communicate and make decisions in an efficient, effective manner. If elected, I would be pleased to face the challenges coming up for the station. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Gene Bradley, and I'm running for a seat on KBOO's Board of Directors. I've been a KBOO volunteer since 1998, and during that time I've worked book and record sales and answered phones during pledge drives, emptied a couple garbage cans here and there. And I've also had an opportunity to be on the KBOO Board of Directors since 1998. During that time I was KBOO's treasurer for five of those years, and served as president for two terms. On the board, I've had an opportunity to work with many talented and dedicated people, and together we've accomplished a great deal. We've almost doubled KBOO's membership since 1998. We've set up an endowment to provide for KBOO's future. We've tried to invest your hard-earned dollars to make KBOO a better place through radio. There's a lot to do still. I'd appreciate your support. I'd appreciate your vote. My name is Gene Bradley, and thanks for supporting KBOO Radio.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Looking Glass Books, an independent and eclectic bookstore proud to be a partner with KABU in the free exchange of ideas. Looking Glass is located at 318 Southwest Taylor in downtown Portland. For information, the number is 503-227-4760. And also by a grant from Metro, the Oregonian, PGE, and KPOJ, presenting Open Spaces, Treasured Places, 8,000 acres saved and counting. Metro is celebrating your natural areas September 1st through the 11th with hikes, music, biking, fine arts, kayaking, bus tours, and an event at the Oregon Zoo. Details at www.metro-region.org. It's 2 minutes after 9 o'clock. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Here's the lineup for the next 2 hours of programming. Up first on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews former Portlander Alifair Burke about her new mystery novel, Missing Justice. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, SW Concer previews the upcoming Stumptown Comics Fest at Portland State University. At 10 o'clock, host Lisa Loving's guests are local organizers of the National Summit on Voting Reform, who are bringing speakers to Portland in September, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And at 10:30, Stage and Studio presents Part 2 of Hearing Voices, Old School Special. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Now here's Between the Covers.
My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of talking to Alifair Burke. Alifair, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You used to live in Portland. Did you listen to KABU when you were in Portland?
A little bit, particularly in my Reed College days.
In your Reed College days, yeah. When you were an unreconstructed lefty?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And now?
I spelled women with a Y. Oh, and geez. Then I became a prosecutor. I've lived many lives.
I was wondering why feminists couldn't spell. I'm probably going to catch hell for that, but that's okay. Anyway, the title of your latest book is Missing Justice, published by Henry Holt. Was there ever a real Henry Holt, I wonder?
I don't know the story of that, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, neither do I, but it's immaterial.